Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two segments today following some comments on the economic situation. First, in about 7 minutes, we'll hear from Huffington Post reporter Ryan Grimm about a strange cash hoard the Chicago Housing Authority has accumulated despite a long waiting list and a failure to maintain apartments. And then at the bottom of the hour, Joel Shalit will explain the Israeli election results. It's been a while since I talked about the economic situation, so here goes. June will mark the sixth anniversary of the end of the Great Recession. By some measures, the recovery from that miserable event has been impressive. We've added 11.5 million new jobs since the job market bottomed out, which didn't happen until 8 months after the recession's official end. And the unemployment rate is down from a peak of 10% to 5.5% as of February. This improvement in the job market is quite impressive when set against the historical record. I've been tracking the performance of the U.S. against that recorded in 15 major previous financial crises identified by the IMF in its April 2009 World Economic Outlook. Generally, the IMF found that recessions following such financial crises are longer and deeper than the garden variety downturn, and the recoveries from them are much weaker and more troubled than usual. That general description certainly sounds familiar to people who've lived through the last 8 years since the crisis began manifesting itself. But strange as it may sound, the recovery in the U.S. labor market has been better than the historical record would have suggested. Total employment is now about 2% above its pre-crisis peak set just over 7 years ago. For the average post-crisis recovery, it took 9 years just to get 1% above the pre-crisis peak. Job gains have accelerated in recent months. We added over 3 million jobs in the year ending in February, an average of just under 300,000 a month over the last 6 months, compared with just over 250,000 in the previous six. And those gains have come despite continued declines in government employment, down over 500,000 since the job market trough of February 2010. Most of that decline comes from shrinkage at the local level, though the federal and state sectors are also in the red. As a share of total employment, government is back to 1960s levels, and federal employment, despite all the bellyaching to the contrary, is at the lowest share since modern employment stats began in 1939. Back then, it was just over 3% of total employment. Now it's just under 2%. But, and you knew a but was coming, right? Things are far from rosy. The share of the adult population working for pay, the so-called employment population ratio, is up 0.5 percentage point over the last year, but it still remains nearly 4 points below its pre-recession peak, and is now at early 1980s levels. To regain the pre-recession level, we'd need to add about 9 million new jobs. Some decline in the employment population ratio might be expected as the baby boomers retire, but an aging population explains only about a third of this ratio's weakness. Despite its recent strength, the job market is just not creating positions quickly enough. One reason is that U.S. corporations are far more interested in accumulating cash surpluses, avoiding taxes, and taking each other over than they are in investing in their underlying businesses. And another reason for this structural shortfall seems to be a decline in entrepreneurship. As I've said here before, American life has long been brutally volatile, but it did have some dynamism to it. That now seems gone. The rate of new business formation, while up from recession lows, is still low by historical standards. That's important because the bulk of job creation comes from young firms, those a year or two past the vulnerable startup phase. And we don't have as many of those as we used to. Why this isn't clear. It could be not enough finance, or finance of the wrong kind. There's recent research showing that countries with large financial sectors, and God knows we have one of those, do worse on standard economic measures than those with smaller financial sectors. It could be a loss of what Keynes called animal spirits, a sense that the whole culture is tired, alienated, and rotten. Maybe that's too pessimistic. Job gains are finally translating into higher incomes, though it took a while. A monthly estimate of real median household income from Sentier Research, a project of two Census Bureau alums, is up over 3% during the past year. It fell almost 2% in the recession and then fell another 7% in the 2 years following the recession, something that shouldn't have happened but did. Inflation-adjusted incomes are up over 6% from their 2011 low, with more than half that gain coming in the last year, but they're still almost 5% below their pre-recession peak. That pre-recession peak in household incomes was just about the same as it was in 2002. For a country built on the promise of upward mobility, a 5% real decline in income over the last 13 years also shouldn't have happened, but did. Despite the recent strength in the job market and in household income, people aren't spending money as freely as you might expect. Retail sales have declined for 3 consecutive months, something they normally don't do in expansions. and the sharp decline in gas prices, which should have freed up scores of billions of dollars to be spent elsewhere, hasn't had the expected stimulative effect on spending. It could be that people aren't too confident about the future, so they're banking the cash instead of spending it, but we don't really know. In the face of all this, the Federal Reserve is now signaling an end to the regime of extremely low interest rates that has prevailed over the last 6 or 7 years. Some people in the bond market and some officials in the regional Federal Reserve banks are worried that the unemployment rate is getting too low, which would mean workers would get demanding and employers would have to bid up wages. There's no sign of such a thing happening, and God knows workers could use a raise, but fears do not need a rational basis. Sometimes they're just a class reflex. You can't let the workers have it too good, or they'll develop an attitude problem. So far, Fed Chair Janet Yellen hasn't acted on these hawkish fears, but it's looking like the years in which the Fed was quite indulgent are now behind us. That indulgence probably contributed some to the recovery, but it also left the financial markets awash in money. All the crazy things are getting financed these days. For some reason, the investing class thinks Pinterest is worth $11 billion, are the beneficiaries of that regime of indulgence. It's going to be very interesting to see how things change as money gets less easy. And, of more consequence, we'll also see whether the Fed is making the same mistake it did in 1937, tightening our way back to a relapse of depression. Let's take a musical break, and we'll hear from Ryan Grimm. Some of Money, Power, and Glory by Lana Del Rey. My first guest is Ryan Grimm. He's the author, along with two of his Huffington Post colleagues, Arthur Delaney and Kim Belwar, of a piece on the HuffPo website, Rahm Emanuel's Housing Agency Sitting on Hundreds of Millions of Dollars with Massive Waitlist. Most public housing authorities around the country are broke, the result of a long funding squeeze at every level of government. Despite a serious housing affordability crisis in many cities, funding public housing is the last thing on any powerful person's mind. The Clinton administration, as Ryan Grimm will tell us, deregulated public housing and left local authorities free to do what they want with the money Washington sends them. Having largely abandoned the notion of public housing, Clinton's main idea for promoting affordable housing was low-down payment mortgages, a contributing factor to the subprime crisis that emerged a decade later. So why has the Chicago Housing Authority accumulated a nine-figure surplus? Here's Ryan Grimm with some answers. Welcome, Ryan. Chicago's public housing authority has an unusual problem for a public housing authority. Most of them are strapped for funds, and Chicago has hundreds of millions in surplus. Tell us about that.
Sure. This is quite a remarkable discovery that a nonprofit group in Chicago made, because the housing authority under Rahm Emanuel in Chicago has been saying for years that it would love to do more about the situation with housing in the city, but that unfortunately it couldn't. It's running at a deficit. One particular woman at this organization dug into their numbers and their budget and realized that there was a lot of shady accounting going on, and found the reverse of what you usually find. Instead of fudging their books so that it looked like they had more money than they do, they were fudging it so it looked like they had less. It turned out that they were sitting on at just hundreds of millions of dollars at one point, getting close to around $600 million. And so once they were sitting on that huge pile of cash, they started doing interesting things with it, such as throwing it into their pension fund and paying down early almost $200 million of long-term debt that they didn't need to pay down, so that the number would be slightly smaller. But still, their last audited report in 2013 showed they were still sitting on, after that, $440 million with a massive waiting list.
How did they manage to accumulate that much money? Where's the money come from?
This is all federal money. So they get about $900 million a year from HUD. And over the last several years, dating back before Rahm took office, they were, although it accelerated under him, they were not spending everything they got in. They can get credit for – they were getting money for vacant units. They were getting money for vouchers that they didn't actually give out to people. So every year they were racking up $100 million plus that just kept piling on top of itself. The reason they were able to do this, interestingly, goes back to Rahm. Rahm was a Clinton aide in the 90s when a law was passed that allowed housing authorities to apply for deregulation. In 99, when Rahm went out to Chicago, he was not only on the Freddie Mac board, but he also was the vice chair of the Chicago Housing Authority. And that's when they applied for deregulation, which was granted by Andrew Cuomo, who is a good friend of Rahm's and politically simpatico. He then went to the House, then became Obama's chief of staff. He's now back in Chicago, and his agency is fully exploiting the deregulation, which basically means they get $900 million a year, roughly, string-free money that they can do what they want with or not do anything with it.
And this is unique to Chicago or other cities too?
No, there are, I believe, currently 39 cities that have gone through this deregulation. Last year, according to HUD, around $350 million was allocated to these cities and just simply not spent on housing. And Chicago accounted, however, for almost a third of that.
What is the rationale behind this? Is this a policy that was supposed to do something other than accumulate pointless surpluses?
This goes back to the whole block grant mentality. So instead of, there used to be, different streams of assistance that would go to the city and would be overseen by the federal government. One stream for vouchers, another stream for affordable housing construction, another for rehabilitation. Instead, what this would do is it would say, well, here's $900 million. You do with it or not with it as you please. And there was an entire kind of political, and still is, a movement around these block grants. And one thing it does is it enables the creation of these surpluses, which can then be invested. So it's kind of a financialization of the program, but it also makes it easier to cut. It's harder to cut very discrete programs, but if you have $900 million going out, only $700 or $800 million of it is being spent, it then becomes easy for a budget slicer to say, well, let's trim this down next year to $850, and the next year to $800, and next year to $750.
And meanwhile, there's a long waiting list for Chicago housing, right?
They kept their waiting list closed for a long time, which was keeping the list artificially short. They recently reopened it and now have some 280,000 people on it, which gets you close. That's a significant portion of the entire population of Chicago.
Yeah, this is a city of, what, 3 million or something? We're talking about like 10% of the city has on the waiting list. That's a remarkable number.
Yeah, it is. It's an absolutely stunning number. And another key number is that between the last two censuses, 182,000 African Americans left the city of Chicago. Only about 70-some thousand even remained in the region. So it's not like they were simply just pushed out into the exurbs or the suburbs. A lot of them are on kind of a reverse great migration back to Atlanta and other places around the country. A lot of the activists in Chicago see this as trying to accelerate that. If you have money for housing and you're not spending it, maybe eventually poor black and brown people will give up and just leave.
And at the same time, they're not really maintaining these properties in luxury condition either, are they?
No, they're not. They're not spending. They're not spending much money at all, and they're leaving them vacant, which is completely rational if you can get dollars from the federal government for a vacant apartment, just like you can for an occupied apartment. So it makes perfect sense. Now, interestingly, so we got a statement from the Chicago Housing Authority on Saturday, I believe, and we kept holding our story, waiting for the mayor to respond. Finally, the mayor's office did respond late last night with interestingly, a statement from the Housing Authority that they were passing on to us, saying that, yes, we have this massive surplus. However, we're going to spend it all, and we have projects planned. So if that happens, hey, that'll be an interesting turnaround. So it's conceivable that some of this will get spent. But even in the statement to us, they said by the end of 2015 they would still have a $165 million surplus effectively.
I'm speaking with Ryan Grimm, who's a reporter at the Huffington Post and author of a story along with Arthur Delaney and Kim Belwar, Rahm Emanuel's housing agency sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars with massive wait list on the Huffington Post website. And the federal government doesn't care that this money is not doing what it's supposed to do?
They actually do care. And we got a statement from HUD that Jen chided the city for not spending the money, saying that, it's true that Chicago has a lot of freedom to spend this money, but we strongly believe that it ought to be in the hands of the people that need it most, or something along those lines. Now, HUD is occupied by Democrats, and Chicago's occupied by Democrats, so they're going to be, they're on the same team, so to speak. So to get, for them to be even gently critical, particularly in the run-up to an election, is something. So for the bureaucrats at HUD, they look at this and they don't like it. It's not obvious to me, though, that they even knew about this, because there's very little oversight as a result of this deregulation.
This is classic, deregulation. You would think that when you deregulate something, you need to pay more attention to it, not less. But there's a long history of this.
That's the feature of the whole deregulation. That's kind of the whole point of it. Leave us alone. Let us do what we want with this. And the idea that you would give that to Chicago, of all places, is kind of amusing from an outsider's perspective.
Right, and certainly the president is no stranger to the political culture of Chicago.
No, not at all. But this is something that House Republicans are strongly in favor of and are pushing to expand around the country, and the Obama administration too is wants to expand this particular program to other states and cities if it can.
That could be just a prelude to cutting it, as you said earlier. Right?
Sure. If you were somebody working a budget and you looked across the country and you saw that, well, here's the Chicago Housing Authority with zero debt because they've paid it, close to zero debt because they've paid it all down. It was a fully funded pension because they shifted a lot of their surplus into their pension, and here they're still sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars. Sure, the logical step is they clearly don't need all this money. Never mind the 10% of the population that still needs help.
And now there's a scheme called Moving to Work that fits into this. What's that about?
That's the name of the deregulation. It's a strange name. Doesn't have anything to do with anything. But it's the name that was given to the 96 law that Clinton signed that allowed housing authorities to pool all of their different federal streams, spend them as they wanted with little oversight, as long as they were replacing all of the affordable housing that they were losing by, knocking down, big public housing high rises or whatever else they were doing.
As I recall at the time, this was part of a theory called spatial deconcentration. The problem, the reason we had so many poor people is that it was like a communicable disease. We had too many poor people together. If we scattered them to the winds, there would be less poverty.
Yeah, and that's an interesting argument, given that this didn't happen by accident. Redlining which is the policy where the federal government would essentially not allow black people to buy homes outside of particular neighborhoods simply because they were black, is what created the concentrated poverty in Chicago. You know, on the other hand, I used to live on Roosevelt Island, and I loved the, and, you know, I was broke at the time, and I loved the mix of you know, high income, low income, middle income people who were all thrown into the same buildings. So I think there is you know, there's something to be said for, you know, allowing poor people to live in crime-free and nice neighborhoods, if you can make that work.
Now, of course, one doesn't want to be too cynical, but you might think that starving the housing authority, well, maintaining a large surplus and starving it for maintenance opening up the waiting list, is a plan to just get poor people out of the city.
Yes, and some of the activists I spoke to for this story, you know, say that, you know, they talk about how Rahm often refers to his goal of making Chicago a, quote, world-class city. You know, nobody would object to that on its face, but they wonder what exactly he means by world-class city, and what in Chicago's history makes it less than a world-class city, and is this just code for wanting the black and brown people to move out of the city? And there are certainly there are interests in Chicago, developers, bar and restaurant owners, anybody else who wants to see gentrification, you know, take hold and carry on, you know, who don't want you know, public housing projects in the city, and they don't want vouchers being given to people who are going to you know, make it anything less than a quote unquote world class city.
Yeah, I wasn't. I never thought of Chicago as an obscure place before. It's a strange aspiration.
Right. It's not being very kind to the history of Chicago. It kind of always has been, you know, a world class city. So I think that does give, you know, some ammunition to the people who are kind of worried about what he means by that, whether or not they have a place in it.
Yeah, well, it sounds like he means an upper class city, not a world class city.
Yeah,
got to compete with Manhattan for the pied-à-terres for the billionaires. All right, thanks, Ryan. That was Ryan Grimm, a reporter at the Huffington Post and author, along with two of his HuffPo colleagues, Arthur Delaney and Kim Belwar, of a piece on their website, Rahm Emanuel's Housing Agency, sitting on hundreds of millions of dollars with massive wait list. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the first movement of Haydn's String Quartet No. 1, performed by the Kodaly Quartet, from their marvelous collection of the complete Haydn quartets. Next up is Joel Shalit. Joel is the author most recently of Israel vs. Utopia from Akashic Books. He's the news editor at Year Active and editorial director at Souciant. Israel voted to keep the vicious reactionary Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu as prime minister the other day, though of course in a parliamentary system matters are not quite so simple as a direct election. It's depressing, but it's also clear that there's no alternative to the regime of permanent austerity and war that has dominated the country's politics for as long as I can remember. It's not like the Labour Party is much better. There are some similarities to our two-party system, with one representing the bad and the other the worse, although Israel has quite a few minor parties as well. Here's Joel Shalit, who divided his youth between the U.S. and Israel and now lives in Berlin, to tell us what's been going on. So the press here is portraying Bibi's victory as a landslide. Is that a correct perception?
No, it's not. But Bibi did poll. In the end, Bibi polled much better than was expected. Bibi's strength is not necessarily in his general popularity as much as his ability to form coalition governments that work in his favor. And this time out, you know, it was a no-brainer, particularly given the fact that he did a very good job of appealing to his core constituency by explaining in very metaphysical and existential terms what kind of threat lay before them, imagined or not, if a center-left government was allowed to assume power in Israel.
And what about the congressional address? Did that have any impact on domestic Israeli politics?
Not as big as you would imagine. But the thing is that the address to Congress helped thematize and articulate general anti-American feelings, which are deeply ingrained in the Israeli right, you know, and it's a very anti-Americanism is very profound, even though many people on the Israeli right in the national religious community as well as in the general religious community tend to be Americans. But you know, you hate what you come from, right? I mean, Bibi is the most American prime minister we've ever had. He grew up in the United States.
But, you know, you say anti-Americanism, and I'm thinking, you know, what, a limitless supply of F-16s and $3 billion a year isn't enough?
They want the weapons, they want the diplomatic support, but they otherwise, as has been widely reported in recent weeks in the United States in coverage of the congressional address, they have utter disdain for American culture and American values as they're perceived in Israel. You know, and those values in that culture for them is exemplified by Barack Hussein Obama, right? You know, the reason why they don't like Obama has as much to do with the fact that he is a dark person of ethnicity and not a less dark person of ethnicity like Jews are. So the racism is profound. America represents the multiculturalism to them that they feel they are forced to reject as part of the crisis with the Palestinians.
You said that you talked earlier about Bibi's constituency. Who is that exactly?
They're a mix of religious conservatives, nationalists, and immigrants from the former Soviet Union and American fiscal conservatives.
So it's tight-fisted and bellicose.
Absolutely, these are, for lack of a better term, in an American context, he gets the redneck vote and he gets the businessman. You know, he's a Thatcherite economically, and so he gets a lot of buy-in from the financial community because of the extent to which he engineered the transition from a neo-socialist economy to a radically deregulated free market economy.
And it's not doing so well, right? I mean, the Israeli economy is in rather dire shape, isn't it?
No, exactly. The economy is not tanking, but it's on a downward trend in terms of earnings. And Israel is now characterized by amongst the most radical discrepancies in wealth in the entire Western world.
And this has no electoral impact?
Not for the people who voted for him necessarily. You have to remember that the people, for example, who live in the settlements and support the settlement project tend to be beneficiaries of the last vestiges of what one might call Israel's welfare state or public sector. The settlements in particular, in many ways have more in common with the old Israel than the new Israel. They get huge grants from the government and lots of subsidies and all kinds of spheres, which the rest of Israel does not get. And a fair amount of that money comes from American taxpayers, I'd like to add.
And, of course, American philanthropists, too, right?
So yeah, yeah, yeah.
A very generous flow of public and private money, and they still hate us. Huh?
Yep, exactly.
His appeal, seen from a distance, to boil down to paranoia and hatred, is that an unfair characterization?
No, that's entirely fair, and that's what he has. That's what Bibi has rhetorically over the, you know, what is referred to in the press as the center left, if one could call, you know, Avodah, the Labor Party, center left. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous at this point. A lot of left wing commentators in Israel, you know, throughout this election campaign, kept on pointing out that at the end of the day, there's not a lot that separates Likud from Labor. You know, and that was part of Labor's selling point, was that they did represent a more, you know, liberal, optimistic, and humanitarian worldview. But in reality, you know, economic policies would largely have remained the same under a Labor government, and the occupation would have continued for the most part. I mean, they may have talked to the Palestinians, but, you know, talking to the Palestinians is not the same thing as settling with the Palestinians.
And, of course, there's a real melange of parties in Israel. So who are these other players besides Likud and Labor?
In terms of Bibi's own constituency, again, it's a, you know, he was able to, he will be able to rely on in putting together his new government, you know, the Habayit HaYehudi, the settlers' main party, led by Naftali Bennett, who's a real nutcase, but, you know, an American Jewish software impresario who, unlike many of his colleagues in the settlement movement, lives in the liberal Tel Aviv suburb of Ra'anana. And then he's, you know, you have Shas, the ultra-Orthodox Sephardi religious party. They'll most likely enter Bibi's government. And you've got Israel Beiteinu, Avigdor Lieberman, the Moldovan bouncers party. Lieberman, for his loyalty, will likely be given the defense portfolio, from what I've read, which is a real disaster, because Lieberman and the Americans, I are very aware of this, at least in this administration. Lieberman is an architect of Israel shifting its strategic alliances to Moscow, away from the United States. So, you know, imagine the Israeli Air Force flying MiGs and not F-35s.
How likely is that to happen?
Oh, I think that the defense establishment will push back pretty hard. The Israeli military is wired too tight to the U.S. Military for that to happen. But the pressure has been exerted off and on throughout the last 7 years, 6 years, you know, that Bibi has been in office, because of the prominent role that Lieberman has played in the government during that time. You know, and the Russians would love to be able to pry Israel out of the American orbit for lots of reasons, you know. In the same way that they play with right-wing forces in Europe right now, such as Orban, you know, in Hungary. So it's no deal. You can't separate it from the kinds of efforts that the Russians are making to shake up the European Union in that regard. So, in any event, the government is not going to look that much different from what it looks like now, but it will probably be more right-wing. Some commentators are already looking at what the composition of this forthcoming government will be and saying it will be the most right-wing government in Israel's history.
That seems like a no mean feat. I mean, it's been drifting right for years, so this is just an extension of that process.
That's absolutely correct, and it's not surprising. Again, I mean, I think that from my perspective and from the perspective of many people I've talked to in the last, you know, 12 hours, why was everyone so convinced that there was actually going to be a dramatic change? You know, even if Labor got into power, would it have been that much of a change, you know? I think that there tends to be an overinflation of things like these, you know, these poll figures and what they mean in Israeli politics. And we, you know, among other things, I mean, there have been dramatic disappointments that have continually characterized Israeli politics over the last 15, 16 years, you know, the era of the end of the peace process and the emergence of the hard right as the, you know, core source of political power in the country. And so, like, for example, if you'll remember when Amir Peretz led the Labour Party to victory a number of years ago, people thought we were going to have our first multicultural Sephardic democracy in Israel, and they went exactly the opposite direction. Amir Peretz, he got the defense minister slot ultimately in a coalition agreement with Ehud Olmert and Kadima, and completely mismanaged the Lebanon War. I mean, who would have ever thought that a union leader of Amir Peretz's, politics would have been defeated and destroyed so resolutely? But again, you know, we all thought that Peretz was going to usher in a more liberal, humane, and inclusive Israel, and in fact, the exact opposite happened. The degree of in which we found our expectations as Israelis and as, you know, American Jews interested in Israeli politics shattered is typical of this process, and the disappointment of this particular election is no different.
I'm speaking with Joel Shalit, news editor at Euractiv and editorial director at Soucient. And what, if any, was the role of the Arab vote? If it's 20% of the Israeli population, does it matter electorally?
Yeah, this was the one thing to crow about in this with this election is the performance of the Arab of the joint list, as it was called, of Arab parties and the Jewish Arab Party Hadash, the former communists. They came in third in the elections, an unprecedented showing as far as. Arab voters and Jewish voters who vote for Arab parties are concerned. It's amazing. The parties that constitute the joint list are a real source of political power now in the Knesset, and this is we haven't seen anything like this in years, if ever. I mean, granted, I'm sure that I'm missing something, but I can't recall such a parliamentary breakthrough from the Arab parties. In an ideal scenario, the joint list would have been able to collaborate with the center parties, that otherwise known as the center left parties, and exerted a positive influence in a governing coalition. We'll just have to see what kind of influence they're able to exert outside of a coalition context as members of the opposition. But all the more power to them. They did wonderfully. And Eman Odeh, the general secretary of Hadash, I mean, he exerted a wonderful shadow over these proceedings at a very dark time. I'm totally impressed.
Would Labour ever enter a coalition with that joint list?
They wouldn't. I doubt they would. You know, I've always doubted they would, but it's possible they may have felt that it was unavoidable, and that might have set a dramatic precedent in Israeli politics. That it's reasonable, it's the right thing to do to work with Arab parties in government. There have been Arab, legislators in government, but there would have never been anything on the scale of the joint list participating in a national government.
And I think early on election day weren't BB's people screaming about the heavy Arab turnout, trying to get their base to turn out too?
Oh yeah, they appealed. BB appealed to the most racist stereotypes. He deliberately promoted racism in order to get the troops out. It was just appalling. And this bit about there will never be a Palestine. Well, you know, he really worked the lowest common denominator.
What should we make of that remark? I mean, I've always thought there would never be a Palestine under the current configuration, but was it somehow precedent breaking for him to say this out loud?
Yeah, it was. He was saying what everybody has always thought, but has so far chosen to, ignore or overlook. What it means is that in the big picture, he's giving the bird to the Americans who insist on, a continued good faith effort in the two-state solution. But, in reality, Israel is a single state. Israel-Palestine is a single state and will likely never not be one. It's just a question of part of the state being governed by the army and part of the state being governed by a parliament. You know, and the Arabs live under the army.
And some citizens are more equal than others.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been Israel is fascinating from that perspective insofar as you do have, for all intents and purposes, an apartheid a formal situation of apartheid existing in the occupied territories and in Israel, more soft discrimination against Arab Israelis. Not formal in its apartheid-like character, but certainly a product of the same kinds of attitudes and discrimination taking place. And so it's the Israel has always succeeded, I think, publicly in terms of getting away with the persistence of racism against its domestic Arab minority and the situation in the territories, insofar as it's been able to point to the situation of neo-equality that exists in Israel proper and say, look, we're not an apartheid state. We're a liberal democratic state that practices inclusivity and it's inside the borders of Israel proper. Why can't you abstract that to the regime, the colonial regime that exists in the occupied territories?
And getting back to the American angle, since we're narcissistic Americans here. We now have Obama having an obviously tense relationship with Netanyahu.
Yeah.
And the congressional Republicans really doing an end run around Obama, then making even tighter friendship with Netanyahu. What are we to make of this? I mean, certainly Obama's days in office are dwindling down now, but is this a significant this sort of divided relationship with the U.S.?
Well, you know, I mean, Bibi and Obama have infamously not gotten along ever since the beginning of Obama's, you know, first term in office. There was lip service, you know, a little more lip service paid to Politesse in the first months of, you know, their relationship. But, you know, we should remember that the whole purpose of the Republican courting of Bibi Netanyahu is not that the Republicans are interested in Israel, but they're interested in finally breaking the monopoly that the Democrats have on the Jewish vote in the United States. And they think that American Jews remain so invested in Israel that if they bring Bibi to Congress and turn him into a hero, it's going to translate into higher rates of Jewish voting for the GOP. You know, it's an ill-founded, stupid assumption. I mean, the American Jewish community is changing dramatically in its relationship to Israel, and the American Jewish community has not just historically been democratic, but I've seen poll figures to the effect that like 78% of the community voted for Obama in the last two elections. The Democrats, irrespective of their own problems as an ostensibly liberal party, the Democrats can count on the Jewish community in ways that the Republicans will never be able to count on the Jewish community for votes.
And, of course, there's a fraught question of money, too. I mean, we've got Sheldon Adelson financing a bunch of the Republican right, most Jewish campaign contributors out of Wall Street and Hollywood and such are still very loyal Democrats. Is there any chance of changing that around?
No, not at all. You know, people like Adelson will continue to spend a gazillion dollars on trying to move the Jewish electorate to the GOP, and it's just not going to work. The cultural differences between the Jewish community in the United States and the Republicans are too great. They're too great. You know, Jews, as someone who lived in the United States for many years and who follows American Jewish politics very closely, you know, even though there will always be a certain percentage of Jews that vote for the GOP, the general sense amongst the majority of the community is that the Republicans are a white Protestant party, you know, and a rural party, not a party of the cities, and a nationalist party, not an internationalist party. You know, Jews are very educated, cosmopolitan, and middle-class people in the United States, and they see no corresponding relationship between Republican values and who they are as Americans.
Yeah, and of course, you know, famously, most Jews under 40 in the United States are, you know, less and less interested in Israel as time goes on.
They identify as Americans. They don't identify as Israelis in training.
Back in the Israeli domestic scene, is there any kind of left? I mean, not the centrist, you know, labor kind of left, but any kind of actual, you know, what people outside Israel might recognize as a left, internationally speaking?
No, it's too fractured. There's too much competition for would-be left-wing voters. There's too much confusion about what an actual left-wing or liberal left political orientation might be like in the mainstream. There's a lot of left-wing thinking, and there is a lot of left-wing Israelis, but there's no corresponding political structures that they can appeal to that are effective on a parliamentary level in the slight. And I'm continually reminded of that because I'm a resident of Berlin, and all I'm ever told is that Israelis are moving to Berlin, and they are. Berlin is turning out to be one of the most Jewish cities I've ever lived in, and I never expected that. And I live in an Arab neighborhood, and they all come there to eat hummus and talk to the Palestinians and Turks that are my neighbors.
Well, it would seem that this migration out of Israel to places like Berlin are removing, so we say, some of the better people out of Israel, and
that's been happening.
Leaving the remainder even nastier and more right wing. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, and it's a terrible problem for Israel. If what you want to imagine is that the country will eventually be able to transform itself politically, internally, without the benefit of immense foreign pressure or a devastating war with its neighbors. But the diaspora in Europe feels like it's growing, and the Jewish diaspora, and in a lot of ways that's good for historical reasons because of what happened in Europe during the Third Reich. But on the other hand, it also helps point out the hopelessness of the Israeli-Palestinian situation as it exists and as it communicates itself to Israelis today. I mean, I'm living in Berlin, and every time I go home, I feel terribly conflicted that I'm not there. But I can't make a living in Israel, and I find the political situation so despairing, and that's like the base level feeling that sends so many people away who otherwise would live there.
And what about the people like you got Yahoo's like Jeffrey Goldberg saying the Jews should leave Europe and go to Israel?
Yeah, well, I'm finishing a book right now. I'm in the last stages of writing a book about Jews and Arabs in today's Europe. And when I read the kind of stuff that's coming out of American Jewish pundits like Goldberg, I can't help but feel that they have absolutely no understanding about what the situation in Europe is like, and they have no business commenting on it. I mean, they're so far removed, in the same way that in Israel we used to complain that people in the diaspora just don't get Israel because they're not here. American Jews, especially on the center-right, are absolutely clueless about Europe. A classic example is people like Goldberg, who can't seem to ideologically distinguish between the immigration crises that influenced Jewish life in France versus Germany. Two very different countries. Two countries in which the Jewish community is having absolutely opposite experiences with its Muslim compatriots, In Berlin, for example, and in Germany, there's been a history of collaboration and cooperation between the Turkish community and the German Jewish community. And yet American Jewish commentators tend to conflate the crisis of the French Jewish community with the situation confronting the German Jewish community. I mean, very different countries. It's like trying to compare Mexico to the United States. They may be in Europe, but that's as far as it goes. And Europe is not a monolith. But I think because the Jewish community in the United States came from Europe and is very far removed from its experience in Europe, American Jews tend to see Europe as being the same thing no matter where you are. Europe is Europe is Europe, and Jews have the same experiences in Europe no matter where they go. It's absolute bullshit, but it's you can understand it, but it needs to be corrected.
And finally, the new government, more of the same, more settlements, more war, more neoliberalism?
Yeah, yeah. All the above, and really, all they're going to be doing is waiting for a Republican government to enter the White House so that they can have an easier time of it abroad. And they're counting the days, the minutes, and the hours until Jeb Bush is president or someone of that, a Marco Rubio.
I think it may be time for me to move to Berlin too. Okay, thanks, Joel. That was Joel Shalit, author of Israel vs. Utopia from Akashic Books, and news editor at Euractiv and editorial director at Souciant. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of How Much Can I Hate by the Israeli punk band Dir Yassin. The band, formed in 1997, named itself after the site of a 1948 massacre in which Zionist paramilitary forces killed over 100 Palestinians. The paramilitaries were the Irgun, headed by Menachem Begin, who would later become prime minister, and the Stern Gang. Avraham Stern was, it's no exaggeration to say, a fascist who sought to make an alliance with Germany and Italy in the 1940s to promote the creation of a Jewish state in the Middle East. Naming your radical anti-Zionist band after the site of a massacre was, needless to say, a provocative act. Till next week, bye.